The Tom Woods Show, episode 1073.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, everybody always thinks the current U.S. president must be the worst, but man, is there competition for that title. Check out our free course on the presidents and their crimes against liberty at freehistorycourse.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Brian McClanahan joins us once again today. You know Brian, he is the author of many books, most recently How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. He holds a PhD in history from the University of South Carolina, and you can find him over at brianmcclanahan.com, Brian with an O, brianmcclanahan.com. That's where you can also find his podcast, The Brian McClanahan Show. Lots of great Brian McClanahan stuff over there. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
All right, we're going to have some fun talking about a variety of different things. We're first going to talk about the experience you had with your book, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America, and what that was like. We'll get to that in a minute. We're also going to talk about your own evolution from neoconism to where you are now. And I just never tire of hearing stories like that, people's philosophical evolution. And I am pretty certain that people in the listening audience feel the same way. And I think a lot of people in the listening audience made that same evolution. Or actually, I have people in this audience who've made all different kinds of changes. Some of them came from the left. Some of them haven't made a transition yet, but they're just curious and interested. I love all my listeners. So that stuff is going to be very interesting. But let's talk about How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. You published that last year with Regnery Publishing, which is a mainstream conservative press dating back to the 1950s, published many seminal books over the years. And Regnery is very plugged in to the right wing. Regnery, at least back when I was publishing with them, the company that owned them also owned the Conservative Book Club. But I'm not even sure if the Conservative Book Club even exists anymore. Do you know, Brian?
It does. Yeah, oh, it does? They have it. Yeah, they still have it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. So Regnery, the Conservative Book Club, and I believe Human Events were all under the Eagle Publishing umbrella. I think it may be different now. But anyway, the point is they are very plugged in. They can get you on the radio. They can get you on TV sometimes, print interviews, whatever. And you would think with a book on Alexander Hamilton, if conservatives knew their own history, they would know that Russell Kirk, one of the seminal intellectuals who helped build the post-war conservative movement, said that Alexander Hamilton did not qualify as a conservative. So you would think there'd be plenty of appetite for Hamilton bashing among conservatives. And yet, what happened?
Well, the exact opposite. In fact, when the book came out, it was crickets in a lot of ways. I mean, I did have some interviews, but one that was really interesting, I had a couple that were just stood out as emblematic of this Hamilton worship that's going on in America now. One was with the Jim Bohannon Show, which is a nationally syndicated show. It's on a late night show. And actually, I hate doing late night shows. And so I was called by the publicist and said, look, this is a Jim Bohannon show. It's on, you know, it's a big show. Would you stay up late to do it? So I had to stay up till 11 o'clock at night. Normally, I'm in bed way before that. So this show was going to be on at 11 o'clock at night on a Friday. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. I'll go on and do it. So I get on his show. And he proceeds to attack the book the entire time, because how can I have the audacity to say that Alexander Hamilton screwed up anything? This guy is the greatest man in American history. He's a real conservative. And he started saying some really funny things. First, he actually said, and I couldn't believe this, and I had to pause for a second and ask him, did you really just say that? He said that Hamilton never got his bank. And so I thought, wait a second here. Did he just say that Alexander Hamilton never got the Bank of the United States? Of course he did. He had the first Bank of the United States. It was passed. And this is the big debate between Jefferson and Hamilton about the constitutionality of the bank. And then I hear him in the background typing on his computer. You know, sometimes you can hear that. You might hear me. He's typing. And he comes back and he says, oh, yeah, well, he got the bank. But then it went away. So he started saying all these crazy things. But the gist of it was that how can a conservative get on the air and somehow attack Hamilton? And it devolved into this conversation about decentralization, secession, nullification. And of course, he started giving me the neocon line that nullification is treason, or lawlessness, secession is treason or lawlessness, all these kind of things. And we got so far away from Hamilton. But really, that's what's at the core of all of this, is that Hamilton, opposing Hamilton, represents a threat to neoconservatism, what you called, you had an ism. I just call it neoconnery because it's a con job, but it represents a threat to that. And so I think that's why so many of these conservatives can't understand that Hamilton is really problematic for him, because all the things they talk about, limited government, you know, small this, small that, Hamilton was the exact opposite of all of that stuff. And yet he is considered to be one of them. So it's amazing to me how the neocons embrace Hamilton. And like you said, even Russell Kirk, who called John Adams a conservative, but yet didn't call Hamilton a conservative. And it's so interesting how that is in 50 years or so, how this Hamilton worship has really taken hold of the conservative movement.
And if I may toot my own horn a bit just for a minute, my opening statement in the debate I did with Michael Malice, just the opening statement, and I love Michael Malice dearly, but he's wrong on this. The debate we did on Alexander Hamilton, just my opening statement makes a case against Hamilton, certainly that would resonate with libertarians, but that should also reach conservatives in terms of Hamilton's interpretation of the Constitution and all kinds of other things. Maybe I'm being naive, but it just shocks me the level to which conservatives have sunk, that they would not recognize in Hamilton and the Hamiltonian program and approach the key to American history, to understanding why things went the way they did and why things are the way they are today. And you know what? Maybe I'm being more naive than I think, because actually, if their vision of America is this one nation, indivisible, you know, semi-empire, then maybe the Hamiltonian vision is what they want after all, and it's not an error.
Well, I think you're right, and that's what it comes down to. You know, there is, it's the idea of this national greatness conservatism. And that's they're nationalists. And so the other day I was actually on Twitter, and I saw that Montel Williams had posted something tweeted something, and it was something to the effect that the GOP, what happened to the states' rights part of the GOP? And I was a little shocked by that. You know, this he usually doesn't put stuff like that. And I said, well, look, I responded very quickly. And I said, look, this is par for the course. For the last 100 years, both parties have been about centralization. And he actually said, he responded. He said, well, yeah, I agree with you, but you know, at least the GOP talks a different game. And that's the point. I think when you get down to what the Republican Party is, it really hasn't changed. I know some people they get very upset when I say that, particularly staunch Republicans. And I say, look, the Republican Party, the stupid party, has always been the stupid party. It hasn't changed since the 1860s, really since the 1850s when it was founded. It's always been a nationalist party. It's just that so many people have been duped into believing this very strict constructionist, in many ways Jeffersonian view of America, which was the dominant view of America for nearly 80 years. But they believe in that this is really what the Republican Party is. But when you look at look at what they do, not what they say. And so that national greatness conservatism is what they're all about. And Hamilton really espoused that. And I think that's at the core of why these people can't get over when somebody bashes Alexander Hamilton. He represents everything that they believe in. It doesn't have anything to do with an intellectual dispute. It has everything to do with what they really want, which is a national government that does what they want to do. Just look at Jeff Sessions and this entire issue with marijuana legalization or decriminalization, or it's foreign wars or adventurism, whatever it is. These are the things they want: a very powerful presidency that can rule with a pen. They're okay with it as long as their guy's in office. So that's why Hamilton represents them, and why all the neocons have such a hard time when you bash Alexander Hamilton.
Well, this whole Hamilton thing really sticks in my craw, because if you get Hamilton wrong, you just get so much else wrong. But I want to ask you a related question. If you were to compare the amount of media coverage you got, media exposure, for your Hamilton book as compared to your other books, what would that comparison look like?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, when I came out with, just the year before, I had The Nine Presidents Who Screwed Up America. Now, granted, that title is very catchy. I actually I've been at places where the book was out on a table and someone walked by, didn't know who I was, and they saw the title and they stopped. What? You know, I have to look at this. So the title was very catchy.
Right.
But I was doing media for that for months after that book came out. Months. This book, about 3 weeks and it was done. So in terms of the exposure and the types of programs I was on, It was so much different. Now, I will say one person, and I actually like doing interviews with him, was Dr. Drew. I don't know if you remember Dr. Drew.
Of course.
Yeah. He is really good. He's actually a fair-minded interviewer, and he's curious. And he interviewed me for the Nine Presidents book and then had me back on for the Hamilton book, and he was actually siding with me a lot. So he was really good. And the funny thing was about that is when I was on his program first, we were actually talking about California secession and how he thought that was a pretty good idea. So here he is out in California saying, yeah, I like this. I kind of like talking about this. It's something new and interesting. So there are intellectually curious people out there. And I think that's where we're going to get in the second part of this interview and how we all got there. And he was really good. And if you can ever go and you want to listen to a radio program that's on the actual radio, not a podcast, I think he would be one that I would find that would be interesting to listen to.
Huh, I would not have guessed that. Well, I'm glad you had a good experience on that show. I think back now to some of the crazy interviews I've done over the years promoting books. I remember the Joey Reynolds show. That was on CBS Radio. I remember it was one of these interviews I had to drive all the way into New York to be there in studio with him. And I think I was promoting my book on the Catholic Church and Western Civilization. And he had a copy. He obviously hadn't even looked at it. And halfway through, he asked me, so what is Zionism, by the way? It was like, this is something that had been bothering him for a while. And he figured, well, you seem smart enough. I'll ask you the question. Has nothing to do, it's not a million miles within what I'm talking about. I could not get over that I wound up kind of satisfying his historical curiosity on a bunch of completely irrelevant topics. Very, very annoying. But my all-time favorite one was on a much more obscure show that I went on, and it came time to take calls, and one of the callers called in, and it was almost as if the caller hadn't been listening to the show. The caller said that he was convinced that government officials were exchanging secret messages with each other via the political cartoons in his local newspaper. And the host at that point said to me, Tom, by the way, I don't know if you know, but we don't screen the calls on this show. And yeah. I thought, well, how about that? You don't say, really? I would never have guessed.
I've got a good story like that, too. I was on with a friend of mine in kind of a local talk show, and he didn't screen the calls either. Well, he had a guy call in, and he started talking about the chemtrails conspiracy. And the host, straight face, starts saying, well, you know, that's not a problem for us because Brian and I have been vaccinated for those. Have you been vaccinated for them? It was great. And the guy starts saying, really? You can get a vaccine for that?
Oh,
it was absolutely hilarious. So it was one of the funniest things. I had to actually put the phone so I couldn't, because I was laughing so hard at what this guy was doing to this poor caller. Hilarious. So yeah, I mean, this is the thing you get. If you do enough radio shows and you do these very local shows or small shows, you're going to get stuff like that. It's a lot of fun sometimes, but then, as you know, you get these situations where you just scratch your head and say, how did we get to that? How did we go from talking about my book to Zionism in one segment?
If we have 3 hours to kill, fine.
Right.
But I'm here to promote my book, and you're getting a free guest, and that's really how the exchange is supposed to go.
Right.
Now, let me ask you about this. You have written on a variety of topics, on the Founding Fathers and the Constitution. You've written on the presidency, you've written on American heroes, on Alexander Hamilton, all this, a lot of different sorts of things. So you're not just a Southern historian by any means, but I think of you as a Southern historian, in part because you did study under Clyde Wilson at the University of South Carolina, and some of your writings have been in defense of the South, and you have an interest in the South.
Right.
But you're from Delaware, so how did that happen?
Well, that's actually a fun story. You know, I wasn't always. This is the transition you get in life. And so I was actually born in Virginia, but then, you know, I went to high school in Delaware, and my family's not from Virginia originally. They're actually from Nebraska and New York. So I mean,
you're all over the place. Okay.
Yeah, so not from the South. But when I went to college in Maryland, I had a professor there. And I won't say his name to draw any fire, but he was very much pro-Southern. And and we started, it was kind of a growth for me. And not necessarily that I was, you know, oh, this guy's pro-Southern, so he's brainwashing me into a position. He started asking questions that I found very interesting. And I remember I wrote a paper on Stephen Douglas. And in this paper, I laid out the different positions on popular sovereignty. And I'll never forget because, of course, I had to talk about the Southern position. And I was just writing about this, and I'd read some books on it. And I thought, well, you know, the Southern position isn't necessarily wrong. I mean, it's a different kind of position. It's not something we would look at today and say, well, we support that. But I gave it a very even-handed treatment. And he put a whole bunch of exclamation points and said, you know, something to the effect, you're the first person I've ever read in a student paper that's actually been at least somewhat agreeable, or at least not to demonize the South. And so he and I had a lot of conversations. And over time, I started to connect the dots. And, you know, looking at these issues of limited government and, you know, how we got to where we are. And I started thinking about, well, is Lincoln really a conservative? Is Hamilton really a conservative? And that was, you know, an eye-opening experience for me. And actually, I was the president of the College Republicans.
Wow. I was the vice president of the College Republicans.
Yes. And the funny thing was, you know, we didn't have, well, I was the president because the group was just basically gone. And a buddy of mine called me up one day and he said, you know, can we do this? Can we start this thing again? And I said, sure. And he said, well, you're going to be president. I said, all right. So that's how I became the president. It wasn't a great election or anything, but that's how it happened. And so we started having these little meetings. We had some people come out, and we actually tried to organize a conference one time. All right. My senior year in college, we organized this conference, and I had all these neocon, politicians from the area come in. And we actually had David Horowitz as our keynote speaker. Now, Horowitz can be fun. I mean, the guy is completely irreverent at times. I don't know if you've ever heard him speak, but he can really be funny. But I reserved this big room. We thought we're going to have all these people. We had like 10 people show up to this political thing I was going to do. And what's really amazing about that is, I don't know, I'm sure you've read the Kennedy brothers out of Louisiana. You know,
sure.
Ronnie and Donnie Kennedy. And so I was reading their book. I had no idea at that point about the book that made them really popular was The South Was Right, which was just this totally politically incorrect book that, you know, you'd see it. But they had another book. I didn't know anything about that book, but I saw this other book, Why Not Freedom? And I picked it up and I started reading this thing. And he started talking about the 10th Amendment and all these other things and secession. And I started thinking, yeah, I mean, so I actually invited one of them to come out to go to this conference. And I made a mistake. I actually mistyped their name, and they just completely stopped talking to me. So here I'm, this college student. They weren't talking to me anymore. And it's funny because now, we talk all the time. And I told him that story. I said, you guys are one of the reasons why I started thinking about things like nullification and the 10th Amendment and states' rights. And I started moving away from neoconery. And then, of course, it was looking at graduate school, and I ended up getting involved in South Carolina and Clyde Wilson, and that continued the process. But I remember I actually told Clyde Wilson this one time. I said, and I'm embarrassed for saying this, but at one point when I was first at South Carolina, I said, you know what we need? We need another good war.
Oh.
And nowadays I look back at that and I think, oh my gosh, I was such an idiot. But, you know, it's never too late. I think that the moral of that story is it's never too late to start living, to come around to the other side. And even as I went to South Carolina, I still wasn't fully understanding where I needed to go with some of the ideas that I had. So it's the process is, it's always fun, you know, when you look at that. And I know you talked about the same thing, how, you know, when you were in as an undergraduate, you were pro-war and, you know, we need to go into the Gulf War. We need to do these things and go kill these Middle Easterners or whatever it was. And you had the same kind of transition.
Yeah, that's right. Now, on Clyde Wilson, let's talk about him. You went to the University of South Carolina for your PhD. You studied under Clyde Wilson. Clyde Wilson was an enormously knowledgeable person. I mean, he's still with us, but he's no longer at the University of South Carolina. He's retired. But he just knows an immense amount of Southern history. He is, of course, the editor of the Calhoun Papers, which is an immense scholarly undertaking. He also knew an awful lot about conservatism, real and fake. And I wonder, did you learn this stuff from Clyde, or did you learn this stuff and that made you seek out Clyde?
It was, I was getting interested in going and studying with people like Clyde. In fact, I was either going to go work with Clyde or Forrest McDonald. And so Forrest McDonald was at Alabama. And I don't know if I've told this story in your podcast before. I've told it other places. But actually, you know, during spring break my senior year, I had applied to all these places. I was trying to decide. It was going to be either South Carolina or Alabama. I had applied to some other places too. And so I drove to South Carolina and I met with Clyde. And when you meet with Clyde, I didn't really meet with Clyde. In fact, what happened was I showed up. I talked to him on the phone for about 2 minutes. He said, you know, come by my office. And if you know Clyde, of course, he has a speech problem. It's hard to understand him. But he said, come by my office. And so I show up at his office and two of his graduate students come in, John Devaney and Kerry Roberts. And so Kerry Roberts is now at Liberty University and John is a headmaster at a private school, I think in Virginia now. But anyways, they come in. And Clyde sits back and says, this is John Devaney and Kerry Roberts. They're going to talk to you. So I'm shuffled off to this room and they interrogate me. It's like they put the white light on me and they kept asking me all these questions. Why did I want to work with Clyde? Why did I want to do this? And John Devaney, do you know John Devaney at all?
I do know John. I haven't talked to him in quite a long time, but I do know him.
Well, he was throwing the Oxford Dictionary at me. He was trying to see where I was intellectually, and it was really fun. So anyways, and then I went to Alabama, and I met with Forrest McDonald and his wife, and of course, Forrest is now dead. And his statement was, after I told him what I wanted to do, go work with Clyde. So I went to go work with Clyde. Now, I had some inclination, you know, this is where I was going with it, but of course, Clyde helped develop these things. And you're right, Clyde was friends with Mel Bradford. Clyde was involved in Modern Age long time ago when it was still a really good magazine. He was doing things. Of course, he was with Chronicles magazine for years, but he was doing things with conservatism long before you know, that we had this neocon paleocon split in the 80s. In fact, he was very much involved in that trenches part. He took part in that battle in the trenches when Mel Bradford was booted by the Reagan administration, and that really created a split in the conservative movement. But you know, in the early 80s, he wrote a book, you know, Why the South Will Survive, and he was such an influential conservative voice. A lot of his friends, Sam Francis was friends with him. A lot of his friends, of course, went on and worked for the Washington Times and other things. But Clyde stayed at South Carolina, and he never did anything else. So just to go and work with Clyde and be connected to that was quite a thrill, actually, that you're working with this guy who was so connected with all these old voices of old conservatism, the old right. And of course, he helped me along the way. He was always the one that was bashing the Republican Party and helped me really see the light. You know, the Republican Party is not good. This is not a group you want to be tied up with. But that was part of my growth process, certainly.
He was also anti-imperial wars. He was a real paleocon. I first learned about him from Chronicles magazine, which I read very faithfully in the early 1990s, and I met him in person for the first time in 1993 at the John Randolph Club meeting, where I was the youngest attendee, and man, I just drank it all in. That was a tremendous opportunity to meet a lot of great people. I had met Lou Rockwell before, but I met him again. I met Justin Raimondo there, Paul Gottfried, a lot of wonderful people I've featured on the show. Bill Kaufman, whom I love dearly. And if you haven't heard the Bill Kaufman episodes of The Tom Woods Show, go to tomwoods.com/episodes and do a search on page for Bill Kaufman. What a tremendous guy. And I might add, by the way, that this is that fusion of traditional conservatives after the Cold War who wanted to go back to non-intervention, or so-called paleocons, and the paleo-libertarians, the Lou Rockwells and Murray Rothbards. And we're told by left libertarians, this was a terrible decision. It was a bad move to associate with these people. Well, when they say that, what they are saying is, you know, you shouldn't be, associating with Clyde Wilson? I mean, if you took all the left libertarians in the world, put them together in terms of their knowledge of American history, they wouldn't be half of one Clyde Wilson. So, and who cares what a bad move or good move? Are these people smart and do they have something to teach me? Then I want to talk to them.
Well, I would ask those people that say that about Rothbard. Do they know that Murray Rothbard supported the Dixiecrats? Do they know that?
Yeah, some of them do. That's why they don't like him.
Well, but I mean, it wasn't the 90s when Rothbard made this decision. He was making these decisions long before that. And so that's the funny thing that, you know, they say things like, well, the 90s is this really crazy. No, I mean, it was long before that. And Murray was intellectually curious. And this is what you're basically saying. He liked smart people. He was interested in ideas. And so he wasn't going to discriminate, you know, based on what somebody said about somebody. He really wanted to get what these people really were. And so, I think that's the fun part of it. And, you know, but again, my growth in where I am today was absolutely, you know, Clyde Wilson was a major part of that. And of course, again, in foreign policy, you know, Clyde has come out and he was one of the few people that ever talked about Calhoun as being anti-imperialist. And there's actually this book by this guy at Princeton now, and he's written this book about Calhoun, the imperialist. So that's usually the impression you get of Calhoun. But Clyde has always said, and I would trust Clyde more than anybody else when it comes to Calhoun, that no, John C. Calhoun was actually an anti-imperialist. And that's a position that you don't often hear.
That's right. I've heard Clyde talk about that as well. When it comes to Murray Rothbard, I just want to come back to him for a minute. I met him a handful of times, but every time I saw him, we had a long conversation. And in one of those conversations, he told me that his next goal was to learn more Southern history, that he had a bunch of books and he was going to go through them. So it wasn't to be, but it's just interesting to know that he was going down that, you know, intellectual road. He wanted to pursue that area of inquiry. Let me ask you something somewhat different. Where'd you publish your first article? Because I'm curious to know how you broke into this area. You were doing your PhD with Clyde, but then how does Brian McClanahan burst onto the scene? Where was your first article published?
My first, let's see, article in what way? I mean, are you just talking about anything popular or...
Any kind of print publication you wouldn't be mortified to tell us about.
Oh, first print publication. You know,
I can remember this easily. You can't remember your first article?
Well, because honestly, Tom, my first real major print publication was my Pig to the Founding Fathers.
Wait a minute, what? You hadn't even published a magazine article? I have never heard of this before.
I was doing this it's a very strange process, isn't it? I had never written anything before. You know, see, because I was in graduate school and then I left. I started my PhD and left, and I got a real job. I worked in sales. And so I was just out there doing a job, and I wasn't really doing much with anything academic. And I got a teaching job, and I decided, you know what, I'm going to go back because I can make more money with a PhD. So I'm going to go back and get my PhD and finish up. But again, I really wasn't doing much with that. And almost right after I finished, I had the opportunity to write The Pig.
Just so everybody knows, that stands for Politically Incorrect Guide.
Right. So I had that opportunity. That was it. So if I think about my first print magazine article, it didn't register as much because I had written the book already. That was my first real print when I could see my name somewhere and you know, lights and saying, this is a print publication. This is me.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, after that, I mean, I've written, I can't remember, you know, whether it was, you know, something like, I actually wrote an article for, let me think. It was Glenn Beck's Fusion Magazine, one of those. And then, of course, you know, something, you know, Human Events or Town Hall. I wrote some of the things like that. Chronicles, I've written something for. But, you know, it really wasn't. Those didn't really strike me as much as that first book. So I was unconventional in that way, that my first real name and lights in a print source was a book. most people don't do that.
That's very interesting. All right, I wrote my first article probably like 9 or 10 years before my first book came out. I think it was, it must have been 1994 because I wrote an article about my college commencement. I wrote it for Chronicles.
Mm-hmm.
The commencement speaker was Al Gore, so it was the usual, I mean, the whole event was just a series of inane, you know, absurdities. So I wrote it up and it became my first article. And then I became a somewhat frequent writer. I mean, I must have had, I don't know, at least half a dozen articles in Chronicles. I wrote for the Freeman in the early to mid 90s, even the late 90s. In fact, I earned my way to the John Randolph Club meeting that I told you about by writing an article. I wrote an article for the Freeman. It earned me $300, and I used that to get my airfare, and I made it out there.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, I can't remember the last time I wrote for a print publication. I just don't do it anymore. I don't know if it's because I'm burned out or what, but I just like doing the podcast and when I do writing, it's generally to people on my email list. They get to read what I write.
Right.
That's pretty much what I do. I enjoy doing that. And by the way, to get on my email list, you just go to tomsfreebooks.com. You get yourself a free ebook while you're getting on it. And I send out pretty interesting stuff, I think. So you're not going to regret getting on there. You can always unsubscribe, but you know, you don't want to be a loser. But anyway, that's pretty much what I do with my own writing these days.
How do you subscribe to Brian McClanahan's email list, by the way, which you should also read?
You just go to brianmcclanahan.com, Brian with an O, of course, and at the top of the page, it'll say, give me an email address, and I'll give you a free ebook. It's Forgotten Founders, and there's an audiobook. You get the ebook and the audiobook just for giving me an email. So then you get on my email list, and you'll get probably about 2 a week from me. It's usually what I do with my podcast. So every time I do a show, I send out an email. And so to remind you to go listen to my podcast.
All right. Nice. How about war and the military? What was the straw that broke that particular camel's back for you?
Well, again, I think it was just looking at working with Clyde, of course, and starting to look at this this different type of perspective on war. And actually, one of my minor fields in graduate school is military history. So I was always interested in the military and strategy and tactics and all those things. But I think that looking at the other side of the American empire, and embarrassingly, again, I'm going to tell you, I wrote a paper as an undergraduate on James K. Polk, and I've done a podcast on this, and I admitted it on my own show. I actually talked about how Polk was not aggressive. He was this great American. What he was doing was perfectly right. We should have been more aggressive with Mexico. And so I was an undergraduate. And I did a complete 180 from that as I started reading more about Calhoun and more about some of the other individuals in the late 19th century, you know, the anti-imperialism league and some of these other things. And so I think that's where I really started becoming more interested in the American anti-war tradition, which is often overlooked. I mean, it's almost like you get this idea that Americans have always been pro-war, but that's simply not the case. There's many examples all through American wars where there's been a sizable opposition, and they just don't get the amount of publicity that they deserve.
As we move closer to wrapping up, let's say a word about the Brian McClanahan Show. There is a Brian McClanahan Show. Of course, again, Brian with an O. You can find it at brianmcclanahan.com or on iTunes or Stitcher, any of those places. And Brian, you do this show solo, without guests, which is not easy to do, by the way. And you just talk, and it's just a lot of good, meaty information. And there's some current events, there's some history, and a lot of times it's a current event or a headline that you then inform with your knowledge of history. It's a good show. So you must be up to what, like episodes, like it's in the 120s or something, right?
No, 137.
Okay. All right. I am way behind. I more or less quit listening to podcasts a couple of months ago because I got some good music for the car. And so I kind of fell behind. I'm going to have to get back into that. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. So you're even farther ahead than I thought.
Right.
So yeah, people should definitely check out that show, but, it's a major part of the Brian McClanahan franchise at this point. So maybe you can say a word about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I decided to do that type of format. And I hate to bring up the guy, but years ago, I remember listening to the Rush Limbaugh. Here's my transition again from neoconnery. So I was listening to the Rush Limbaugh show, and I still put it on every now and then just because he can be very funny. But I was listening to it, and he actually made a statement about this. He said, you know, when he started out in the 80s, everyone told him that he would have to do guests all the time. And he said, no, I don't want to do guests. I just want to do me. And I thought long and hard about it. And I said, you know, I could do guests. I could do that. But I just wanted to be me. And so I made a decision. And it is hard. It is challenging sometimes to come up with something to talk about and then talk about it for 20 or 30 minutes. But it's something I just wanted to do because it gave me a podium, right? It gave me a soapbox to get up and talk, as you said, talk about current events or bring in some history. One of the slogan for my show is think locally, act locally. So I always try to do something with that in one way or another to bring that in. But I thought that this was just an avenue for me to talk about some of the things that I'm interested in. And then, of course, hopefully bridge off that with other things that I do. So it was cathartic in many ways. It was for me to just vent. And so that's what happened with the podcast. And I do two shows a week, and hopefully your listeners will check it out.
All right, so definitely check out this amazing Brian McClanahan smorgasbord that you may have been missing out on over at tomwoods.com/1073. Well, I'm really glad we did this. I didn't really know your full story until now. I should do more of these. I should get Kevin Gutzman on, find out his story, his evolution.
That would be a good one.
Of course, with his big head, it would probably be, I knew all this all along. There was no evolution.
When I was born, coming out of the womb.
Yeah, I came out of the womb with all this knowledge. I came out of the womb knowing the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to the states.
Right.
All right, we'll get him on and see what happens. Brian, thanks so much again.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Okay, everybody, that is going to do it for us for today. Thanks so much for listening. If you are enjoying the show, you get super-duper awesome benefits, including membership in my great community, the Tom Woods Show Elite, where you will make lots of wonderful friends, I assure you, if you become a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com. So do think that over. Check out supportinglisteners.com. You see all kinds of neat goodies there, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.